Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Naked Englishman podcast. I'm Richard Vobes, and today is the 30th of October 2024, rapidly approaching the Halloween, are we not? It's something like 7:30. Oh no, it's a bit later than that. That morning, it's an overcast morning again. Another miserable day. But that's okay because I've got two interviews to do today and I have a little bit of writing. And I must post these letters that have come, that I have written or helped write. One for Julia, two for myself, to go off. And and I've got some writing to do on the book. Excuse me. I keep forgetting to charge up the batteries on this Zoom recorder that I do the Naked Englishman on, and it's likely to conk out, so I must, after I've done this one, I must charge up the batteries. So our diarists in history of today, Gilbert White, who obviously was quite prolific and appears in this book, The English Year, compiled by Geoffrey Grigson, says this on this day in 1788 in Hampshire: "Larches turn yellow, ash leaves fall, the hanger gets thin." And that is now what's going on. I think we've passed the pinnacle of the point that I love, which is when the leaves turn all those different colours of golden brown, red, yellows, oranges and all of that. But there's plenty of them. Now I think they are beginning to fall. And then we'll start to see the trees denuded. "It is a breathless grey day," says Dorothy Wordsworth in 1802 in Grasmere, Westmoreland. Well, it is the same here. "That leaves the golden woods of autumn quiet in their own tranquillity, stately and beautiful in their decaying. The lake is a perfect mirror." And that does seem to be, again, a very good reflection of today. So, I mean, you know, not every day where we have a grey sky, clearly, is geoengineering. They weren't doing it in 1802, not across everywhere. And John Ruskin in 1870 says, which is, what, 150 years ago, "growing soft red clouds on blue." And he was at Denmark Hill in Surrey. So there you are. Right, that was our diarist, so it's very nice to hear from them. How are you doing? Are you all doing well? I just seen the lovely Julia off, and I had been smoking my pipe. I hope you don't mind. I am a great fan of a tobacco called Guilty Pleasure, and it's got a slightly unusual taste. It's very lovely. I have been looking at different tobaccos, and this one is particularly nice. Maybe it's because I've had it a few times now and I really enjoy it. I can't explain what it is about it. The great thing, of course, is that tobacco isn't addictive. So that's it's not that I'm sort of stuck with it. I've got to have it, must have it. I don't ever feel that way with tobacco and smoking the pipe. It's a pleasure. It's something one looks forward to. Think, oh yes, but it's not a necessity. And I've gone days when I've completely forgotten about it and gone, oh yes, I didn't smoke a pipe today. Or the need did not occur to me, you know, that sort of thing. So that's very good, very, very good. I have been, what did I do yesterday? Well, we had some letters to write. We had a Zoom conference, not conference, but a meeting to attend, Julia and I, about the education board that we had to ward off as we try to live as much as we can in the private. And what else had we? I had two fascinating interviews, both connected with health. One about German new medicine, which is really interesting, and one about the crystal waters. So they will go out over the next couple of days. I forget what is going out this afternoon now. It may be Crispin, who is the time traveller. Well, the reincarnated chap who appeared, found himself written about in a book 200 years ago. So he claims. So, you know, you've got to take it with a pinch of salt, I suppose, like so much of this. But if it resonates and it means something, you take it with you, don't you? You certainly do. I had a couple of books that I'd ordered arrive yesterday. This one is very interesting. Bear with me. This one is called The Vision of Glory. The Extraordinary Nature of the Ordinary, John Stuart Collis, who has been, first of all, I mean, the trouble with me is as soon as a book comes in, I've got to read a little bit of it. And then I put it down because I've obviously got other books I'm actually reading. But this, the beginning of this was fascinating, and he's talking about atoms in as much as, and now, when was this written? This was written in the 70s, I think. So a lot has gone on since, obviously, he was writing. But he talks about atoms, and he talks about how actually there is the universe and the world that we live in is made up of practically nothing. And I think this is a fascinating thing. You think of the atom and the nucleus and the space. He talks about the nucleus of the atom and the electrons that are going around the atom at huge miles an hour, you know, so millions of miles an hour, go around an atom. And he says, it's like, if you can think of Waterloo Station, and you think of Waterloo Station and you take what would the nucleus be? I can't remember what he says. It's like the nucleus is like a nut, if you like, a peanut or a walnut in Waterloo Station. And then the electrons are like wasps and they're whizzing around. And that's, so in other words, the nut and the space that the wasps whiz around is equivalent to Waterloo Station. And so therefore, he says, the space that's between the nucleus and the electrons is massive. It's massive. And if you collapsed it, he says, take an elephant. And if you were to take the space of all the atoms that are in an elephant and collapse them down, it would be less than the size of a matchbox. Something ridiculous like that. He said, you know, by the time you've taken all the atoms that are actually make up something, it is so small in comparison. He said, basically, everything is just space. But because things are whizzing around, and we always talk about, you know, it's all vibration and energy, that actually the world is more made up of nothing than it is made up of something, which I found quite profound, I suppose. Anyway, I thought I'd just read a little bit from this book to you. This is, I suppose, chapter 5. They're very short chapters, like 1.5 pages, which is why I've got far into it, and not really far at all because it's only on page 10. But anyway, so I'll just, he talks about, I'm not quite sure where we got to really. Anyway, I'll just read a bit, and if it makes any sense to you, it makes sense. If it doesn't make sense, I'm sorry. It's called The New Alchemy, this chapter, and it says, it's not easy to break these bonds. If they are cast asunder, if they are snapped, as you might snap a taut piece of elastic or wound up spring, then energy will be released, and the amount of that energy will be according to the strength of the bond. So I think he's talking about somehow these the electrons and are going around, and it creates a sort of bond on an object. This seldom happens in the ordinary course of nature, for stability has been established in the compounds, as we've seen. It does happen occasionally when lightning, for instance, causes wood to catch fire, as the strange phase goes. Actually, it doesn't catch anything. It is transformed into fire on account of the extraneous force snapping the bonds and accelerating the motion of the atoms of oxygen to form a new compound of carbon dioxide. This transmutation, this electrical reaction, is known as a chemical reaction, and it is upon such liberations of energy that the whole of modern civilization is built up. In search for power, we've been able to use the slow reaction from the unstable compound of coal and get heat to change water into steam that will push a piston and drive an engine. Or we can release energy in a vaporized combination so quickly in a series of combustions that we can dispense with the intermediary of water and steam. Or we can release energy in a mixture of sulfur, charcoal and saltpeter, so very much more quickly than it will burst its container in an explosion. But the compounds of the world are nearly all stable. We cannot easily lose the bounds of the materials. We cannot burn stones. Sorry, we cannot easily lose the bonds of materials. We cannot burn stones or metals. But a lucky chance, we can liberate the energy and thus destroy the transmutation of substance of coal, which is squashed primeval forest, which, on account of certain geological conditions, did not slowly burn or rot into carbon dioxide. And we can liberate the energy in oil, which, by another lucky chance, is squashed marine organisms. Well, that's what they think, but actually I think oil now has been defined as not actually fossilised trees and things. I think the thinking now is that that was a lie, and that oil is found deeper than the fossil record goes. And they call it a fossil fuel, but I think scientists are now saying it isn't a fossil fuel at all. It is something else. And others say it's the blood of the planet, which would be a shame because it's black. Anyway, so yes, I remember watching a video about that in which they said, it's interesting, you have to dig really deep down to get oil out of the ground. But the fossil record doesn't go anywhere near as deep as that. So it can't be smashed up fossils. Then what is it? It seems to be a pure substance in its own right. And I'd be interested to know whether the oil changes in its compound, and you know, you would imagine that some oil would still be fossilized things slowly turning, and as you get further down, it's purer. But I think it doesn't happen that way. I don't know. You know, it's like if you freeze ice, and if you get it before it's all frozen, some of it is still in the freezing process and some of it is frozen. Well, if it was fossilised fuel, you'd surely find some that was still in the process of becoming oil. But it's so deep that it's beyond the fossil record. And yet we call it a fossil fuel. So, it produces the carbon dioxide into the atmosphere that we need. So that's interesting. It was clear that the chemical sources of energy were limited, and that we might soon be compelled to return again to the unlimited supplies of wind and water. Interesting, that's what we're being pushed down, aren't we? Then, at the turn of the century, we discovered the inner bonds of the atom. Before the discovery of radioactivity, the play of the outer electrons had been recognised sufficiently to promote the application of chemistry. But it was not known that another atom, as it were, existed within the atom itself, the final nucleus. The famous splitting of the atom really means opening the inner sanctuary of the nucleus. The radioactive elements showed that it was something sometimes splitting open on its own account and its own pace, and incidentally causing the transmutation of the element involved. I say incidentally, though there was a time when the possible transmutation of elements was a wonderful dream. The alchemists of the old clung to the idea that such a thing was possible, and in their primitive laboratories strove to turn base metal into gold. We can do this today, at least theoretically we can, but we do not want to, and might just as well turn gold into base metal, since any element from which we can release nuclear energy is worth many times more its weight in gold. For while a gram of gold is worth about 7 shillings, tells you how long this book was written, a gram of lithium is worth about £3,000. And of course I imagine that's a lot more expensive. That pounds worth of power can be got out of a gram of lithium. Sorry, that's a pound's worth of power. That pound's worth of power can be got out of a gram of lithium. We've noted how the amount of energy released in a chemical reaction corresponds to the strength of the bonds. But the binding of the outer electrons is nothing compared with the strength of the inner nuclear knots. The question was how to unite them, for it was one thing to break a molecule and get a chemical reaction, but quite another to break a nucleus and get an alchemical reaction. Even Rutherford, this is some scientist, not Margaret Rutherford, even Rutherford thought it could not be done. It's like trying to shoot a gnat in the Albert Hall in pitch darkness, he said to Mr. Richie Calder, and using 10 million rounds on the off chance of hitting it. But we know Sir John Cockcroft was not of that opinion, and other methods have now been devised by means of which the nuclei are encouraged to shoot each other in a kind of furnace called a cyclotron. Anyway, it does get a little bit involved, but it goes on into subjects called like the sun, into light, into colours, into, well, it starts to talk about Newton and... So he's obviously interested in science in some sort of fashion, but the beauty of it, inside the mountains, and talks about trees, the revenges of nature, the forests of the night, the extraordinary nature of the ordinary. I suppose the things we take for granted is what I'm thinking that he means. But he wrote a lot about nature, about the beauty of nature. And he was, for a time, I think he was involved as a farmhand, a labourer, an interesting bloke, John Stuart Collis. I think he died in 81 or something. Have I got the right geezer? Hang on a minute. This was written in the 70s, but I can't remember now I can't remember. Maybe I'm thinking of somebody else. It might be Adrian Bell, I'm thinking of, was born around the turn of the century and died. So I don't know, actually. But anyway, there we are. That's another book that came. I was interested in John Stuart Collis because of a book which is very well known in the sort of farming circles, is the Plough, the Worm... what is it? The Worm Excuses the Plough or something. Forgives. The Worm Forgives the Plough, I think it's called. I'm just looking here on another little book. The Worm Forgives the Plough. And there's a little book called The Wood, which actually is just a little extract from that. I didn't realise that, and I bought it as well. And I've got the book, The Worm... So this is a little... But it's nice because it just talks about a wood. My task was to clear and thin an ash wood. It was situated between Iwerne Minster and Tarrant Gunville in Dorset and belonged to Rolf Gardner of Springhead, amongst other things a forester of no mean knowledge of activity. My debt of gratitude to him for commissioning me to do this work and to reap its reward is outside calculation, but I can dedicate these pages to him. The last time this wood had been touched was 18 years previously. It was chiefly composed of ash, though it also contained a considerable amount of hazel, and also some spruce, larch and oak. In addition, there was the 18 years' worth of undergrowth in the shape of privet and bramble, and a great deal of clinging, climbing, throttling ropes of that hangman's noose called honeysuckle. I could not see into the thickness for more than a short distance, nor advance a single yard unimpeded. As for the ash itself, the trees were of all sizes. There were some very fine single ones, now fully grown, but often a clump of five or six rose from one stool, interfering with each other. My job was to introduce the idea of freedom into this tangle, freedom for the ash, not for all the ash, only for the best, the straightest, never allowing more than one to remain out of any angle, out of any single clump, or cutting down even good ones if they were too close to others. Darwin said that in nature the fittest survive. In fact, he only showed that those survive who, he only showed that those survive who do survive. It is only when nature is acted upon by man that the best, the fittest survive. When man acts upon man, the same principle is not applied. The Spartans alone seem to have pruned our species on principle. We do not do so now, for no one can foretell how a great mind or a skilful a hand may be, could belong to a fragile body. Exactly. So anyway, that's a fascinating book. And Darwin, of course, was completely wrong, and he admitted he was wrong on his deathbed, that the survival of the fittest was in fact a complete lie. But it suited the agenda of the Luciferians. Anyway, enough of this gay banter, and thank you for listening. I shall pop off now. My battery is on its last legs, so I hope some of this was reasonably interesting. And I must get on and make my video of the day. Until the next one, toodle-pip.